try to turn it into some form of musical work. And I agreed with him. So we both started reading all different books of different genres. It wasn't just science fiction. And The War of the Worlds was one of those books that we read. And on the first read, I could really hear sound, so to speak, and was excited about the story.
Okay. Now, was that also A Day of the Triffids a possibility for an album?
It was one of the books that we sort of shortlisted, having read countless others.
Mm-hmm.
Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was all part of that shortlist. But The War of the Worlds is the one that really struck home to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, now the album is obviously based on the H.G. Wells novel. However, was there at any point where you wanted to adapt this for a more modern setting?
No, not really. In fact, it was the fact that it was set in Victorian England that was one of the most appealing factors when you consider that the steam engine was the king of technology at the time. Queen Victoria was on the throne, spreading a very already powerful empire around the world and conquering other nations. And I found that appealing. I've also found that the reality of how humanity could defend itself in the 1890s, when all it had was really rifles and cannons to defend itself with against a superior force both in brain and machinery. So I definitely found it resonating to me to keep it in the time and place and character settings and the storylines that H.G. Wells created.
Well, now that Jeff had a concept, he moved on to adapt the book. As Jeff explains in the next little bit of this interview, the original structure of the book helped him in the structure of the album.
Well, when I first read it, I as I was saying to you, that I really found it very attractive for, mm-hmm. for various reasons, and then did a bit of research on it and discovered that it was a weekly episodic adventure in a British magazine here called Pearson's,
mm-hmm.
and it was written to leave, like the old B-movies, the audience, or the reader in this case, hanging on the cliff edge, wanting to come back the following week and read the next chapter.
Yeah.
And because of its popularity, it was then novelized, and that too became very popular. And I think because it started off life being written as a weekly episodic adventure, I found it easy from a composing and producing point of view to basically follow the key chapters and in the order in which H.G. Wells wrote it. It's not a particularly long book. It's only about 150 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So I approached it the way H.G. Wells did. I divided my work into two halves, as he did. He wrote it as, you know, divided into two halves, and proceeded down that road.
Mm-hmm. And while many well-known personalities graced this this album, including Thin Lizzy's David Essex, the Moody Blues' Justin Hayward, and actor Richard Burton, Jeff goes on to explain the process of choosing the voices, and then you'll hear The Eve of the War telling us, among many other things, that the chances of anything coming from Mars are about 1,000,000 to 1.
Well, by the time I finished composing my first draft of a score, as well as our scriptwriter having completed her first draft of the script adaptation, there was a list of characters that we had decided were going to be the main characters within the musical interpretation. So that was our starting point, and it was a strong foundation to then say, right, we're making a recording here. Who, from an audio point of view, would have the right sort of voices to play these roles? The main role, which is the one character that sort of is all the way through the recording, is our journalist, a man who has survived this Martian invasion some 6 years earlier and is now recounting his story for his newspaper. And all the other parts are mostly, well, entirely, in fact, all from the singing side, even though there's a bit of acting between some of the characters. They all come from the musical world. And each character had as all good characters do, a sort of flesh and bones attached to the type of character that they were to be, and the casting came from that sort of feeling and understanding as the type of voice we wanted to play the particular role.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other choices other than Richard Burton that if you hadn't gotten him, that somebody else that you would have chosen?
Yeah, well, I think the word choice is a very delicate one, in that people of any stature, you don't really choose. You just hope they're going to be attracted to your project. But in the case of the journalist, my dad and I, we sort of created a list of people whose voice we thought would really resonate in a way that what we were hoping was a voice that would sort of suck you into our world of the War of the Worlds. And it wasn't a particularly large list, but Richard was at the very top of it. We both admired the quality of his voice and his acting ability, and really didn't believe that he would be interested in appearing on this recording. But a bit of good luck happened, in fact, at the time that we were completing our list, was the fact that, and I don't even remember how we learned about it, but somehow we learned that Richard was in a play in New York called Equus.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant, therefore, that traditionally you're doing 8 shows a week in the theater. And if I wrote a letter to him introducing myself, trying to explain what I was trying to do as a composer and a producer and what the script was all about, and send him a copy of the script, at least if I sent it to the stage door, I had the best chance of actually reaching him, rather than as we really in our hearts thought that he would, if he even got the package, would turn it down, or his agent may not even pass on the offer to him if we had sent it first to his agent. And that's exactly what I did do, is I sent this letter and a copy of the script to the stage door of the theater, and it couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 days after he received it. His agent rang me back and said, Richard loves the idea, count him in, and we did a deal then and there.
Great.
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us. midnight on the 12th of August, a huge mass of luminous gas erupted from Mars and sped towards Earth. Across 200 million miles of void, invisibly hurtling towards us, came the first of the missiles that were to bring so much calamity to Earth. As I watched, there was another jet of gas. It was another missile, starting on its way. That's how it was for the next 10 nights. A flare spurting out from Mars, bright green, drawing a green mist behind it, a beautiful but somehow disturbing sight. Ogilvy, the astronomer, assured me we were in no danger. He was convinced there could be no living thing on that remote, forbidding planet.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come.
Then came the night the first missile approached Earth. It was thought to be an ordinary falling star, but next day there was a huge crater in the middle of the common, and Ogilvy came to examine what lay there. A cylinder, 30 yards across, glowing hot, and with faint sounds of movement coming from within. Suddenly the top began moving, rotating, unscrewing, and Ogilvy feared there was a man inside trying to escape. He rushed to the cylinder, but the intense heat stopped him before he could burn himself on the metal.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. Chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come. Yes, the chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. Chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come.
It seems totally incredible to me now that everyone spent that evening as though it were just like any other. From the railway station came the sound of shunting trains, ringing and rumbling, softened almost into melody by the distance.
And I'll get to more of that in just a moment. This is Visions and Sounds. Look at the War of the Worlds here on 100.3. It's great. I've had a chance, and be listening, by the way, in the second half of the show, when you might get a chance to win a copy of The War of the Worlds as it stands. It's just been re-released as a remastered release, which I think is great. I think that in a lot of cases, the version that you're listening to is actually, if I am not mistaken, from the the 19, I don't know when it was re-released on CD, but this is the special two-disc set that I had actually got here in an auction. An auction here at CKMS. So it was kind of like a pretty cool to grab a hold of that. Anyway, now strange meteors have crashed in the Earth, and it seems now that the invasion truly has begun. Now, little do people in the Horsell Common realize how much danger they are truly in. Welcome back to A Visions and Sounds special Halloween presentation of Jeff Wayne's musical version of the War of the Worlds. Now, CBS Records, now known as Sony BMG, who are nice enough to provide the copies of the War of the Worlds that you'll be winning in the next hour, they were somewhat behind the project, but as Jeff Wayne explains in this next little bit of the interview, he put a lot more on the line than just his reputation.
They were interested, mm-hmm. but their interest was the fact that I had been having a reasonably good run producing some artists for them, and one in particular who became very popular for a number of years here in Great Britain and a couple of other countries. And so I think just by that, my track record at the time with them, they felt that it was worth backing, even though in truth I think creatively they really didn't know what I was talking about by doing this musical interpretation of the War of the Worlds. Mm-hmm. But I was fortunate to get some of their backing. When I say some, the contract that I signed with them, they invested about one-third of what it cost, and the remaining two-thirds, the larger amount, came from my life savings.
Oh. Wow. So when it went from a single album to a double album, was there any concern that that if this thing fails, that you would be, you know, pretty much have to start all over again, essentially?
Well, I think that's why the investment from the CBS side, as they were then, was limited to a third. It did represent the fact that when I first chatted to them about this whole idea, the idea in my head was that this would probably be a single album, all instrumentals, and that was the end of it. But as I started working on it, it went from a single album to a double. It had more than just instrumentals. It had an integrated script. It had guest artists, had original paintings that came with the package. And that's why it grew from the cost that I was being backed by CBS with to the final cost that it became. So CBS had about 70,000 pounds, UK pounds, and I had the balance to about 240,000. And plan B, in case it failed, either to come out or not sell, was my wife and I had made the decision, go for it, but if it fails, plan B is to sell the house and sort of downsize for a while. And, you know, I wasn't going to be on the breadline. I was being commissioned all the time by artists or producers, management companies to produce their artists, or media commission, so working as a composer, you know, a musical director, a musician, in all those areas that I was working. So we weren't going to struggle in the day-to-day sense, but the house was going to have to go and downsize a bit, but fortunately never came to that.
Right. So now, were you limited by the length of a side of an album? Did that dictate to you how you would structure each of the, acts of the War of the Worlds?
Yes, indeed. In fact, it was simply the fact that vinyl records had a finite amount of music that you could put on any one side, and you had a margin of a few minutes depending upon how much bass you had or less bass. Mm-hmm. But from memory, and I may be wrong by a minute or two, it was something like a maximum of 26 minutes per side. So it did give me a finite amount of length that the War of the Worlds could have been in that era when vinyl was the main format. Cassette tapes weren't that dissimilar in quantity of length as well at that time. So, in fact, my first assembly of the War of the Worlds was over 2 hours in length. Wow. And all you have to do is multiply 4 by 26 minutes, and you can see that I was just slightly over what capacity could be, but it was too long. It didn't hold. It needed to be cut back anyway, so it came down to what
And sorry, he got cut off. It essentially came down to what it could actually get put on the album. Anyway, sorry about that. Welcome back. As well as the music on this, the sound effects were a major component on this album, and many unique and fascinating sounds were created, including a creepy unscrewing sound that was created in a very unique way. We'll continue with some more of this great album right after this little bit of how Jeff explains how the unscrewing sound essentially came about. Here's Jeff.
Sure. It's funny, all through the years, whenever I've been asked about the unscrewing of the cylinder, which appears at the very beginning of the track called Horse Will Come in the Heat Ray, It's one that I've had letters, I've had media people say it's been actually quite a scary sound when you hear it. It does sound like this giant cylinder unscrewing and then crashing to the ground. Mm-hmm. And then, I always blow the whole mood when I tell the reality of how that sound was produced. And it comes down to two of my wife's saucepans from the kitchen, just amplified as I'm sort of scraping one onto the other. And fortunately, my engineer didn't think I was totally bonkers and actually understood the idea of what I was trying to do. And he mic'd up and amplified what I was doing with these saucepans, both in stereo and in a way that got the maximum velocity, if you call it that, out of the saucepans, and it just became a wonderful and big sound.
And here's some more of the Jeff Wayne's musical version of The War of the Worlds here on Visions in Sound. Listen for that, the scraping of saucepans, believe it or not, as the unscrewing sound of the Martian cylinder.
It all seemed so safe and tranquil. Crowd gathered on the common, hypnotized by the unscrewing of the cylinder. 2 feet of shining screw projected when, suddenly, the lid fell off. Two luminous, disc-like eyes appeared above the rim. A huge, rounded bulk, larger than a bear, rose up slowly, glistening like wet leather. Its lipless mouth quivered and slavered, and snake-like tentacles writhed as the clumsy body heaved and pulsated. Thank you. young men crept closer to the pit. A tall funnel rose, then an invisible ray of heat leapt from man to man, and there was a bright glare as each was instantly turned to fire. Every tree and bush became a mass of flames at the touch of this savage, unearthly heat ray. I felt I was being toyed with, that when I was on the very verge of safety, this mysterious death would leap after me and strike me down. At last I reached Maybury Hill, and in the dim coolness of my home, I wrote an account for my newspaper before I sank into a restless, haunted sleep. Alien sounds of hammering from the pit and hurried to the railway station to buy the paper. Around me, the daily routine of life, working, eating, sleeping, was continuing serenely as it had for countless years.
You're tuned to 100.3 FM, CKMS. Gobbed with epoxy and held together with
on
rubber bands.
On Horsell Common, the Martians continued hammering and stirring, sleepless, indefatigable, at work upon the machines they were making. Now and again a light, like the beam of a warship's searchlight, swept the common, and the heat ray was ready to follow.